Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Ballot to Talk About. This week, we'll be previewing the massive series of elections currently taking place throughout India and asking the big question: can anyone stop Prime Minister Narendra Modi from winning a third consecutive term? It is Saturday, the 27th of April, 2024.
To be a president who seeks not to divide but unify.
Not now. I am a fighter and not a quitter.
It's time for a change in this country, my friends. A real change.
Let's keep moving.
Slava Ukraine!
And joining me, as always, from the other side of the world is my co-host Sam. Well, Sam, we've had 1 week on. What Taylor Swift songs have been stuck in your head this week?
Excellent question.
What's the top five?
Top five?
Yeah, let's do a top five because this is obviously the most important question of the week.
Okay, I mean, the answer to the question that you said in the headline, I think, is no, but we'll unpack that a bit later on. But yes, my top five, okay. I love, but Daddy, I love him. Smallest Man Who Ever Lived. The Black Dog, Florida, and the Tortured Poets Department. How about you?
For me, it's as this title suggested, Who's Afraid of Little Old Me? I Can Do It with a Broken Heart, The Smallest Man Who Ever Lived, The Albatross, and Florida. That is my top five. So
lovely, there's a little bit of crossover.
There's a little bit of crossover. And now that we got probably the most important question out of the way, how are you otherwise?
Yes, I'm not too bad, thank you. Looking forward to unpacking another giant election.
And you talk about giant, Sam. I mean, the logistics of this is just extraordinary. So we're talking today, as we said earlier, on the 27th of April. Two phases of voting have already taken place, but there are five phases of voting that's expected to take place over the next month before the results are released on the 4th of June. Right now, about 20 to 25% of the seats in Parliament have already been decided. So, Sam, set the scene. Before we dive into what this campaign has been looking like, what is the outgoing legislature looking like? And what is each party attempting to do in this election? Or alliance, I should be more correct in saying.
Yeah, so I mean, the main contender in this election is the BJP, which is led by Narendra Modi, who has been Prime Minister of India since 2014. And the BJP, as a single party, has held a majority since 2014, achieving a majority both in 2014 and increasing their majority in 2019. And the BJP are part of the National Democratic Alliance with quite a number of other parties across India. And in the last election, the BJP had 303 seats, but their whole National Democratic Alliance held 353 seats in the 543 seat strong Lok Sabha, where you need 272 seats for a majority. Modi is looking for a third term as Prime Minister, which has only happened once before with India's first post-British colonial rule Prime Minister in the 1950s. And he would become the third longest serving Prime Minister if he were to win this election. On the other side, we have a new alliance called the Indian National Development Inclusive Alliance, which helpfully abbreviates to India. And that's an opposition alliance led by the Congress Party, formerly known as the United Progressive Alliance back in 2019. The Congress got 52 seats on their own back in 2019, and their alliance in general had 91 seats for the UPA, so well short of the seat count of the BJP and their National Democratic Alliance. And there were a number of other regional parties across particularly southern India, which made up the rest of the seats in the Lok Sabha. But quite a lot of those parties have actually been absorbed now by either of the two main alliances heading into this 2024 election, which will be a big battle between Modi and everybody who's not Modi, effectively, is what's going on in this election. And Modi and his BJP have made no secret of the fact that they're looking to cross the 400 seat threshold in this election, which would be quite a feat and has only happened, I think, once before in Indian political history, which was just in the aftermath of Indira Gandhi's assassination back in 1984 when the Congress Party won over 400 seats. So it is achievable, and would be quite an extraordinary result. So Chern, before we unpack both of these alliances, I just wanted to talk a little bit about the election in general, because as we've said a few times already in the short time we've been recording this podcast, this election is absolutely enormous. So talk us through a little bit about the scale of this election.
Oh, I mean, you're absolutely right. The scale of this election is phenomenal. Seven phases of voting, over 1 billion people are asked to cast their ballot. It's quite extraordinary, the logistics involved. But I think what by spreading the election date over seven phases in a span of 6 weeks, that has essentially made sure that the campaigns have to travel all around the country, essentially, rather than like the US, for example, where they concentrate on a few swing states because everyone goes to the polls in the United States on the same day. Election day is only one day. But holding it over 6 weeks, Sam, would you not agree that it forces the candidates to potentially talk about certain regional issues at a certain time because those that region's up for election and not other regions up for election? So I think that's the added advantage over spreading the elections over six or seven phases. Unlike a single day election like Indonesia, for example, the United States, where they often congregate to send more populist regions or those swing states like in the United States, the Michigans of the world. Whereas what we've seen over the first two phases of voting is a lot of focus on southern India, because that's where in the first phase, for example, Tamil Nadu, which is the key state for Narendra Modi's ambition, was all of the constituencies in Tamil Nadu was in the first phase and only in the first phase. So he had a lot of talk about what's happening in southern India, Modi's appeal there, before the election then moves further north and other states come into play. Won't you agree, Sam?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are some of the larger states of India that do allocate voting days throughout the seven phases. But yes, there has been a particular focus on some of those really significant states in southern India, and we'll talk about a few of those a bit later on. Chen, a few more things to just talk about the scale of this. You said there was nearly 1 billion voters casting their ballots. Well, there'll be more voters casting their ballots in this than the population of all European countries added together. And in fact, there are 15 million people who will be working as election officials throughout this campaign, which is more than individual votes achieved by the Conservative Party in the last UK general election. And that's because one of the rules in Indian politics is that there has to be a polling station within 2 kilometres of every settlement in the country. But that means that some of the most remote settlements in India have to have a polling station within 2 kilometres. And there's a few fun examples about this. There is one place in the village of Malagam in Arunachal Pradesh, which has a polling station set up for one single voter, because that is the only polling station within 2 kilometres for that person. And there's also one at nearly 5,000 meters altitude in Himachal Pradesh to ensure voters there can vote in northern India, in the Himalayas region of India. So really fascinating. And these election officials are not just driving, but they are walking through jungles, deserts, swamps, some active conflict zones to ensure that polling stations are set up within 2 kilometers of major settlements. And I just think it's really fascinating to see an election of this scale across not just geographic scale, but also population scale to be carried out. I think it's quite an extraordinary achievement. I mean, there was a story I read of one polling station being set up in Himachal Pradesh in 2019, where the election officials walked for nearly 2 days to set up this polling station for a very small number of voters to vote in a really remote community in the Himalayas. And I just think it's incredible.
And what's even more incredible is that unlike India doesn't have compulsory voting. So you could go all through all this effort to set up the polling station for then nobody to vote, isn't
And then
it?
they just turn out.
That is fascinating
You'd
as
be pretty annoyed, I think. You'd be pretty annoyed.
I think I would be as well. Some absolutely fascinating examples there, really, for us to all consider and be and very amused by. The other thing I was going to say about the election as well is, have you had a look at which states are voting across all four different phases? Uttar Pradesh, their voting is across all seven phases that have taken place. So is West Bengal and Bihar. But Maharashtra is not, that is not the case in Maharashtra, even though it has more seats than West Bengal and Bihar. So it seems an interesting thing about how they come up with which states get more voting across more phases than the other, I would say.
I also enjoyed the fact that Tripura only has two constituencies and they're voting across two phases. And then Jammu and Kashmir have five seats, and there's five individual seats are all allocated across five separate phases as well.
Well, I will say that in Kashmir, there's probably a logistical challenge similar to Himachal Pradesh, and making the task a lot more difficult. And the same could be argued in Tripura as well. That's in one of the northeastern states. We have covered it and we talked about it before, so I suspect that is the reason why as well. Outer Manipur, did you see in Manipur? Did you see that it's one and a half polling stations, but another half polling station in the second phase due to ethnic violence. So that just gives you a sheer sense of the differences across India. And what's then amazing, Sam, is the results they itself look forward to is literally a press of a button, and we know the result very soon. It's an incredibly fast counting of results because it's all largely electronic voting. So despite this mammoth phase, we should get the results fairly quickly on the 4th of June. And it's safe to say, Sam, at the rate things are going, I suppose the question is start with this. Is the election a foregone conclusion at this stage?
I think it seems to be looking that way. And there's a few clues, not least the opinion polls, but also the fact that Modi's not just talking about wanting to obtain a third term. He's talking about boosting his majority again and crossing that 400 seat threshold. So even in the campaign's mind, I think it seems a foregone conclusion. And I have yet to see any Congress or India Alliance politician seriously come out and believe that they're going to win this election. And I think that says a lot about where this election is at. And Chen, do you want to talk a little bit about why we might be in this position? Because it seems strange to be talking about an election where we almost feel like we know where the result is heading, but obviously we're going to be talking about whether they manage to increase the majority, drop the seat count, cross that 400 threshold, but we're not really going to be talking about with any seriousness, the prospect of a Congress Prime Minister.
Well, stranger things have happened. I will give the example of what happened in the 1991 Indian general election. But it was quite a seismic event because what we happened there was a nice the economics term is regression discontinuity discon an RD experiment, a regression discontinuity experiment, where what happened was that Congress was doing very badly until in the first couple of phases of voting, and then suddenly it swept the board from after a certain date, it swept all the later phases of voting. But what was that key event that took place? It was the assassination of Rajiv Gandhi itself, and therefore a sympathy factor was going to be developed. So I think
Well, I
whilst we're
guess
saying
that's
that.
also the one thing about this style of voting is that these seven phases will take place across 44 days. Well, we know that a lot can happen in 44 days. You could have a natural disaster. You could have a major political. One of the main candidates could pass away. You could have a war start. You could have anything. I mean, the 44 days was enough time for the COVID pandemic to go from something people were mildly concerned about to full national lockdown. So a lot could happen over the course of this campaign. As you said, it happened in 1991.
Exactly. But it would take an event of seismic proportions to, I think, ch fundamentally change that result. So then let's look at why that is the case. What's key to Modi's enduring appeal? And I think in some ways he's able to be an appeal to different sections of the electorate that the BJP traditionally has not been able to. So in the more populous northern half, which is much more lower income compared to some other parts of India, I think his blend of being one of the recent BJP leaders who has really leaned into the Hindu aspect. And there are tangible examples throughout his 8-year tenure where he has leaned into the Hindu populism aspect to bolster his electoral appeal. One of those is being a famous one is a temple in Uttar Pradesh. It is the Hindu one of the Hindu temples that was built on what is traditionally a sacred was previously a sacred temple for Muslims, a mosque for Muslims, and Modi himself inaugurated that temple himself. So I think that's one key visible sign that he started at temple and he inaugurated that. So he's leaning into that heavily religious aspect, which has appealed to many Hindu voters in the north as well. He has also, unlike previous BJP leaders, I would say, been much more willing to increase social development and social development assistance in many working classes, enable that further boosted that appeal as well. But to many middle class Indians, he has also brought across a lot of major infrastructure developments as well. One of the key things that I have looked at was the electrification of India's railways. It is now nearly at 100% across the country, which is a phenomenal achievement over such a short period of time. Sam, you and I have both lived, well, I used to live in Britain, you still live in Britain. We, in the north of England, they still have failed to get electrification done. But in the course of 8 years, if I look at the pace of electrification of the railways, it has been a phenomenal achievement. And I think even its highway development program has been massively accelerated under this BJP government as well. So there are tangible infrastructure projects you can point to. The boosting of welfare, or certainly the keeping some of the welfare programs that it was traditionally so dear by the Congress Party. And thirdly, this blend of Hindu nationalism, which really worked in the has really ensured that it's worked in the no in the much more populous northern bit of India. Any reaction to any of those comments, sir?
No, I completely agree with all of those. And I think all of those have come together to mean that Narendra Modi is not only domestically very popular, but if you look at the Morning Consult tracker of global leader approval ratings, he's by far and away the highest, persistently the highest, around 75% approval and 57% net approval. And in second place is actually Javier Milei in Argentina with a 36% net approval rating. So he's even yards away from the second most popular leader in the world in their country. And I think the other thing, Chern, is about the economic development and international development of India as well, because India's place in the world over the 10 years that Modi has been in power has dramatically shifted. I mean, their economy has grown significantly. They're now the fastest growing major economy in the world with a £3 trillion GDP, fifth largest economy in the world, and projected to more than double their GDP in the next 3 years, which would mean that they would leapfrog both Japan and Germany to become the third largest economy in the world. However, all under that is quite a big income inequality problem. They're actually 140th in the world in GDP per capita and have around 35 million people in dire poverty living under $2.15 a day. Those figures are disputed by the Modi government, but they're internationally recognised. So, whilst you've got all of this going on, there are some underlying problems. I mean, you have the religious divide obviously is becoming a big problem in India with the Hindu nationalism that Modi represents. And then you also do have some growth because of the expanding middle class in India. It does mean that the poorer parts of India seem to be drifting even further away in economic terms from that middle and upper class that are benefiting significantly from Modi's reforms.
Well, I think the hope for the Congress Party and something that the BJP will be at the back of their minds is the unemployment rate. I think it's something like 5% has gone up in the last over the last 5 years. One of the economic indicators in India that have gone backwards is the unemployment rate. And it's something that Modi himself knows that, and it's he puts it in his manifesto as something that the BJP party will need to do better because of the fact that and I think the reason why they're so attuned to this is the fact that they also look to recent history, in particular the 2004 Indian general election, because Most analysts went into that election thinking the National Democratic Alliance would easily win those elections. They had a India Shining was the then BJP government's campaign to talk about the fact that India was having a feel good factor. There was strong economic growth in the last couple of years of the BJP government. And it was seen that that the BJP had associated itself with a hardline Hindu policy as well. But what we saw in that election was that the BJP lost the election to Sonia Gandhi and the Congress Party over issues like rural poverty, for example, unemployment, and some of those anger towards some of the economic gains not being spread out across the lower caste of the lower caste, more poorer parts of India led to a backlash. And that India Shining campaign, well, Congress was saying India Shining for who? And that resonated with a lot of lower income voters as well. So there is precedent to this, potentially, if you peel away the headlines, this underlying economic factor in the distribution of economic gains, back creating a backlash against the BJP. But I think the situation is very much different from then now. At that time, Congress was a much stronger party than it is now. And now as well, I think the BJP has learned the lessons of that potential pitfall, that 2004 campaign, and have tried to spread the gains of the India's economic growth over a much wider spectrum than it did in 2004.
What I found really interesting was actually looking at some of the education of the education breakdown of voting intentions, because I wasn't really sure how this would fall out, given that one of Modi's biggest appeals is amongst the lower to middle classes, where they've been significantly boosting welfare spending. But actually, you find that he has 66% support amongst people with no more than primary education, but that goes up to 80% with people with any level of higher education. So you see that Modi's, yes, he has a huge appeal across both brackets, but I did find it really interesting that higher educated voters overwhelmingly flock towards Modi and the BJP, which I thought is very interesting.
Well, I think two things to comment about that. Firstly, the BJP is seen as a more pro-business party, which is why those infrastructure gains, the economic growth, and some of the economic reforms that Modi has been able to do appeals to that group. So that's the first thing I will say. On voters towards our lower educated voters, I think one of the key things for those appealing to those voters, and we saw this in Pakistan as well, was the impact of the symbols, if you remember, because one of the things that the Electoral Commission in Pakistan did was they took away the cricket bat, which was the symbol of the PTI, which was Imran Khan's party, because they thought, or the theory certainly was, that the particularly illiterate voters who have no formal education, they often rely on the symbols to identify parties, and then they'll vote for the parties based on that. I wonder as well, for the Congress, which is a long-established party, has had a long-recognized symbol, which I think is a palm. And I wonder whether, particularly for some of those voters, they just look for the palm and they vote according for it. So that is something to say. But nevertheless, 66% is an extremely high approval rating, which I suspect will highly translate into votes in a constituency which is not the natural home of the BJP itself. So I think that's something to say as well.
And do you think that Modi's objective of getting over 400 seats is achievable?
Well, it's quite a tall ask, I will say. And I think it's a good pivot to talk about where he could seek to make the gains to make it over 400, which is the ironically in the areas that have just voted, which is southern India. Which is the only region that has resisted the BJP's dominance, because southern India has 129 seats, which is 25% of the lower house, and the BJP has only won 29 of them. So it's clear that there are lots of gains to be made in this part of India. But I think the problem that Narendra Modi has is that he's not running against the Congress Party in this part of India. If I look at the states which constitute southern India, we've got Tamil Nadu, which is run by the DMK and the AIADMK, which has been they've had a duopoly on the country's politics for decades. Kerala, that's where the Communist Party is strong, and that's been a traditional communist Congress battle rather than the BJP coming into that fray. Andhra Pradesh is where the YSR Congress Party also has a strong footing. And in Telangana, we saw in the state elections, we covered a couple of, well, it feels like a couple of podcasts ago, but it's actually several months ago, is that that was very much a race between a large regional party there and the Congress Party itself. So the BJP is not facing a straight fight in many of these areas. They're often facing the Congress Party and another regional party as well. And these regional parties, unlike in northern India, still have a very strong hold in southern India itself. So, Sam, do you know any reason why these big regional parties and the Congress Party still retain a large appeal in southern India?
Well, I think demographically the country is very different because obviously one of Modi's big appeals is through the Hindutva policy, the Hindu nationalism, and the Hindu population is overwhelmingly concentrated in the northern states of India. So when you move more southern, you're moving more towards secular, you've got bigger Christian populations, bigger Muslim populations, which just the BJP doesn't have no appeal there. But it has to run a very different campaign because it can't rely on just Hindu nationalism in this part of India. So that's, I think, the primary reason why you see a bit of a difference. And also because the way India is made up of lots of states that were at different times different constituent parts of countries and states in their own right, is that a lot of them have got these legacy parties who represents very local and regional interests in that area. And what I do find really interesting, Chern, is that in this election, both the India Alliance and the BJP have been really trying hard to court these smaller parties and bring them into the fold. I mean, the BJP has gained two key allies in this area, which they're hoping will be the key to the NDA alliance in general getting 400 seats, which is in Tamil Nadu. They've courted the interests of the PMK, who've been given some free run seats in that its state. They've also got the Jana Sena under their wing in Andhra Pradesh, who have not been hugely successful in 2019 general election, but again have more of a local appeal than the BJP. So if you can add those votes together, perhaps you're then winning one, two seats. And that's what they're going to have to do, because if they want to get over 400 seats, they're not going to sweep the board in these states, but they need to be going from having zero representation to one or two seats in all of these smaller southern states where they've otherwise been unpopular. But then on the flip side, you've got in other states, like West Bengal, for example, the All India Trinamool Congress, the AITC, won 22 seats in 2019. They've now joined the India coalition, so that's
And left.
potentially and left, but that's potentially 22 seats which are going to be opposed to the Modi and NDA alliance. So you've got growing coalitions across the board.
No, I think the AITC just on West Bengal, I think if they join the BJP, that will be a seismic change in the political landscape of the country. What we did see in West, of course, if you think back to the election, how hard they went against Mahatma Bandari, who, if you recall, was the chief minister of West Bengal, really wanted to oust her from that. She's a former, back in the day, she served in the cabinet of Manmohan Singh. Before she went and founded her own West Bengal-focused political party, she was a cabinet minister in other Congress governments as well. So I don't think that the AITC will join up with the BJP in terms of an electoral alliance. So that's just something to say as well. In some of the other states that you talk about as well, I think it's interesting to note that the BJP themselves are not go well, in some cases they are expanding their presence. They are directly fielding candidates. But I think you're right in the sense that the key to the BJP getting over 400 is forming the necessary allies, because what works in northern India, that particular strong Hindu nationalism, doesn't work in southern India, and they know that themselves. Largely because one thing that I did find was that you talk about Hindu Vista, one thing that has knitted a lot of these southern states together is this nationalism called Dravindra nationalism, which is based on three tenets basically, that seeks to protect the culture, the language, the interests of southern India. That is one, dismantling the Brahmin hegemony. Two is the revitalization of regional languages, which include Telugu, Kannada, Tamil, for example. And thirdly, social reform, and that includes abolishing the caste system, religious practices, and recasting the role of women in society as well. And those key tenets run fundamentally counter to the BJP's central ideology, which has worked so well in the northern half of
And
India.
an attempt to break down secularism.
Exactly. So I think that has meant that naturally southern India has a limited electoral appeal, but I think they are therefore having to resort to these allies to say to these voters that, look, we know that you may not want to vote for the BJP because of all these issues, but here are some other parties and candidates who are representing the NDA, who talks about Modi being an inclusive figure because of the fact that he's included cabinet ministers from these areas, because of the fact that he has brought economic growth to these areas, for example. That is the message they're trying to say, not necessarily the harder Hindu nationalism and the ideology, which might work in other places as well. So they had to tailor their message. They also had to tailor even the parties that these that NDA parties that they have to that voters in Southern India can vote for. That's almost a message which no agree, Samuel. We know you don't like the BJP because of its strong focus on religion, but here is some other NDA alliance parties that, if you like the direction the government is heading, that you can vote for, isn't it?
And Chen, it's not just about expanding their seat count, but it's also about defending what they currently have. Because one of the states that voted just yesterday in the second phase of this is Karnataka, which I think will be hugely significant because the BJP in 2019 won 25 of Karnataka's available 28 seats. But last year, the Congress party on the state election won an absolute landslide. So if the Congress can even slightly translate their success in Karnataka on the state level to the federal level yesterday, then the BJP are going to have to be making up even more ground somewhere else. And Karnataka was a classic example of the kind of BJ campaign you were talking about, Chen, because you didn't see much polarizing religious rhetoric. This was more about Modi, welfare, and infrastructure, which are the kind of different versions of the campaign that the BJP are looking to run in more southern states in India. But I think the BJP path to 400 has to run through Karnataka and retaining a similar seat count to what they got last time.
So, Sam, let me ask you this question. We're talking about where Modi and the BJP is on the offensive in terms of in these southern states, and what are some of the tactics they are trying to get to try and break into these southern states. Where else besides Karnataka are the India Alliance potentially looking for gains? Because it's quite outside of southern India. What are some of the other states that we're looking at?
Yeah, well, I think this is quite interesting because in the northern seats, obviously, the BJP have overwhelming dominance. I mean, Uttar Pradesh is the largest single state in this election. It will elect 80 members of the Lok Sabha. Well, in 2014, the BJP won 71 of those 80 seats. In 2019, that fell to 62. But I think of the 240 million people who live in Uttar Pradesh, which is just absolutely phenomenal to say that. The
Bigger than some
BJP are really
countries we covered.
looking, yeah, are bigger than a lot of countries we covered. But the BJP, I think, are really looking to do really well in Uttar Pradesh. So this is not a state that they've not done well previously. They've done immensely well previously. But if they're going to win that huge majority that they're looking for, they need to look more like 2014 BJP in Uttar Pradesh than 2019 BJP in Uttar Pradesh. If they replicate the 2019 results, I think it's going to be much trickier because they need 50 more seats for their alliance to get over 400. They're going to have to gain in Uttar Pradesh, and Congress are looking again to limit their overwhelming appeal in states like Uttar Pradesh if they are going to block that majority.
I think that's fair. Uttar Pradesh is always the key battleground as well. But it's also notable that in 2019, in Uttar Pradesh, they took the seat of Amethi, which was the long-held Gandhi seat, or Rahul Gandhi was the MP fighting there. He was in India. Not all MPs I have to stand in one constituency, you can stand in multiple constituencies. So he won a seat in Kerala, which ensured that he returned to parliament. But the fact that Amitha was lost was a really bad sign. And then next door, Rae Bareli, which is a long-time seat held by Indira Gandhi, Sonia Gandhi is the outgoing MP. She's not contesting these elections. I wonder if the BJP is looking to that as a kind of symbolic victory to that this is the Congress dynasty, the most famous, arguably, political family seat. And it could fall for the BJP for the first time as well. So I think there are potential gains and symbolic gains in Uttar Pradesh that they could take there. But you're right, Uttar Pradesh is the state to look at. The other state as well, I will say, we go back to southern India, where in the last election, largely because there was a complete change in how they voted, was that the BJP has relied on the AIA DMK party to try and win seats in Tamil Nadu, and they dropped 36 seats, so only left with one seat in Tamil Nadu. So if the AIA DMK can play do a little bit better than it did last time round, I think that will help them get to 400 seats. So that is something to watch as well. So I would say not only Tamil Nadu, but I think an interesting opposition versus opposition state will be the state of Punjab. Because the state of Punjab, you recall in a state election we cover on this podcast in 2023, what we did see there was that the Congress party had 8 seats up five, and the AAP party has only one seat in that election in 2019. Whereas what we saw in 2023 was that the AAP swept to power in the state election there, ousting the Congress party as well. So I think it will be interesting amongst an intra-opposition fight to see what will happen there as well.
Yeah, and it is interesting actually, Chern. Throughout the last couple of years, we were talking a lot about the AAP and whether we thought that they would have a big federal impact in this election as an alternative to Congress. Well, the AAP are now running under the India Alliance, so are working with Congress and have been allocated a number of seats to run in independently. So we might not be seeing that story this time around, but who knows? If the Congress do fall to an even further nadir, there may be more of an argument to look at alternative opposition groups. But Chen, we've talked a lot about the BJP. Let's talk a little bit finally before we end about Congress. So why do you think Congress have yet again been unable, seemingly, to make any inroads in this election?
Well, that's a very important question. It's almost as if, like, the way I see Congress's struggles is that they know that up till recently, they've only known the Nehru Gandhi family. It was led by Jawaharlal Nehru, Indira Gandhi, Rajiv Gandhi. Then his wife stepped in after a break for about 10, 15 years. And then it was Sonia Gandhi and then Rahul Gandhi that dominated this party. They know that that this family no longer has the same political clout as it did in the past. But at the same time, there's nobody else that they know who can lead the party. So I think in an effort to establish a family's dominance, they've sidelined all potential rivals. That has meant that inevitably, when the star has definitely set on the Nehru Gandhi dynasty, you could argue, there is no capable person able to step in and take the party forward. Would you not agree that that's what's happened to the Congress party, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think the original Congress decline in India was partly attributed to the fact that they were very insular, looking within one family for leadership rather than looking outward, whilst you had the populist BJP party on the other side, who at the time, I know it's now become a bit of a Modi-centric party, but at the time was seen as the complete opposite to that, which is you have national figures from across the country, from different families, different political traditions, different tribes. Whereas on the other side, you had the INC, who were a Gandhi family-driven organization, and at the time were suffering numerous corruption allegations that became associated with that family and that group. So you are seeing a few remnants of that, I think, in this election for sure.
And I think as well that the issue with the Congress party itself is that it never found and we see this as well, is that even when Rahul Gandhi knew that he was not popular after the 2014 election, he tried to resign, but then Congress brought him back and his mother as president, so arguably reinforced his family's hold on the party itself. So I think they made a big mistake at the start of the Modi's reign by keeping with that same formula, which the Indian people had so decisively rejected in 2014. And I now look at who is the new Congress leader, and it seems one of the answers some Congress leaders have been pushing is Priyanka Vadra, I think is her last name. I should say that she's Rahul Gandhi's sister.
Yeah, and Chen, I suppose there is an element here of what can the Congress Party really do? Because one thing we talk about with all elections around the world is that government outcomes matter. The economy matters, your infrastructure outcomes matter. So if you're the Congress Party trying to campaign against the BJP, what are your criticisms beyond criticizing the sort of press freedom aspect or the corruption aspect or the religious divide aspects? Because if you start criticizing outcomes and say that you would be a better government for outcomes, well, Modi's infrastructure projects and welfare projects are immensely popular. So are you really going to make inroads when your campaign is based on that aspect, as opposed to campaigning on the sort of democracies at stake aspect, which is the kind of India versus Modi argument that they've gone with? But to a lot of people, does that argument have appeal when their day-to-day lives seem to be better than they were under Congress 10 years ago? So that, I think, is the issue Congress have, and maybe it's outside of their control.
Well, one thing is that Congress has pushed a lot in this election is the fact that Indian democracy is at stake. They posted to Narendra Modi's authoritarian tendencies and one-man show. Certainly, very similar to other Indian prime ministers, such as Indira Gandhi, a lot of power in India is centralized in the prime minister's office. So they are very much pushing the authoritarian, the democracy is at stake line. And I think there are tangible. We've seen in the US in 2020 that I think that was a potent argument in 2020. But I think, unlike Donald Trump, Narendra Modi has been more subtle about it rather than Donald Trump's more brazen attempts, I would say, in 2020. So I think that message was stronger as well. And you're coming across a very different set of values, as you said, in India compared to the US, because, use one of my favorite political science theories that we learned when we were in university. We have Engelhardt's post-material hypothesis, and for example, where beyond a certain income threshold, issues related to environmentalism or climate change and democracy are much more important than your day-to-day economic well-being standards. The reality
And
is,
for
you
a lot of
said.
parts of India, is they're worlds away from thinking about those kind of things.
Exactly. So I think what we're seeing is that Congress can make a dent in some of Modi's support. It's certainly hoping to, but we're talking baby steps to the massive gains he needs in order to gain government. And then comes the issue of the India alliance itself. Because, Sam, there is some evidence that suggests that it's a coalition of convenience more than a coalition of with a so more of a sole aim to defeat Narendra Modi than of coming together of ideological minds. And it seems that all is not well in within this big happy family, isn't it? It's certainly not one of big happy family, isn't it?
No, and I think one of the other problems is the Congress Party have taken absolute control of this alliance and masquerade as its leader. But look at the NDA, where the BJP win an overwhelming majority of all the seats that the NDA end up controlling in the Lok Sabha. That is absolutely not going to be the case in this India alliance, where the Congress Party could end up with one of their worst results for a very, very long time in India as an individual party. So they don't have the sort of free rein, complete control of the alliance that the BJP have on the other side. And I think that's one of the reasons it's been less cohesive.
Yeah, I think you're right. And that makes it even more tricky because I saw polls soon after the India alliance had come together, and there was a big impact on the BJP's seat count. It went dramatically down, and there was a big surge in the India alliance. But then as the cracks began to show, as the AITC has left there, as other parties have voiced their displeasure, Congress dominating the alliance, and particularly the carve-up of seats, as they try in a first-past-the-post system to ensure straight fights against
And also
the
the amount of
BJP.
time it's taken for them to come up with who their prime ministerial candidate actually is.
Well, there's certainly no competition on the BJP side who their prime minister candidate is. So I think all these issues and what we have seen in recent weeks and months is that that gap, which had closed a little bit, have now widened again to the fact that we're now talking about the BJP increasing its majority for a third time. Sam, I can't think of many other leaders who have led their parties to three consecutive elections where their number of seats they held have increased. Can you think of any?
I'm struggling. I'm struggling.
There is one that I can think of, but it's not a federal leader, it's a state leader. Do you know who that is? Anastasia Palaszczuk and Dan Andrews of Queensland and Victoria, because they increased their seat share over three elections.
Oh, of course. Of course. Well, Chern, a fascinating election ahead.
Indeed. And final prediction, Sam, do you think that they will get over 400 seats?
I think they will fall just short of 400. I think they'll still be a three in front of it, but I do think they'll probably increase their seat count again.
I think so too. I think they will fall short. I think you can't break. They are near the high watermark, and right now, these seats to get are extremely difficult to get.
And they would
I
have to
don't.
be winning a couple of seats in states that they had zero representation 5 years ago.
Precisely. And on that note, we will be back in on early June to cover it. But for now, that is it for the latest episode of Ballot to Talk About. Do join us again next time when we will be breaking down the results of the UK local elections and previewing what could be the start of the general election. As always, we will continue to keep you up to date on the world of politics and elections from around the world. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at ballot underscore talk. And please do leave us a rating or review or simply tell your friends about us. You can also email any feedback or comments to ballottotalkabout@gmail.com. My name is Chen Han, and until next time, we will speak to you soon.